Mr. Maven, reel 11. We were just talking about the training and your general daily routine. You mentioned the food was pretty much the same as you got in England.
It was coming, no problem with the food.
Is there no local dishes, local food?
Well, there's a bit of rice, but that was about it. There was one of the pastries, there wasn't anything else. It was all like army food, combis.
Yeah, pretty much army issues.
Army issues, yeah. And but simply could supplement it with in the nappy. When I had stuff where you could buy beer and beans on toast, chips or whatever, you know? And it was good. But I was back into Hong Kong on the weekend, and you could have this Saturday afternoon to Sunday night in Hong Kong, which, when we got there, there was lovely Chinese women, and when we left this country, the English girls were wearing skirts about the knees with a 3-inch slit. When we got to Hong Kong, it was up to the thigh, the skirt. And now our eyes nearly popped out of our heads when we saw these.
So what were your impressions of Hong Kong? Because it was quite a large city even then.
I would have signed on if I'd been staying there. It was great. It was a big metropolis. There was English speaking cinemas. There was bigger bars, there was dance halls, there was girls, there was the horse racing, Happy Valley, is it? Happy Valley race course. Chinese are big gamblers. You can get to the race course. Apart from, we've got extra money. We had an extra allowance of money, so we weren't rich, but we could afford a good weekend out. Plus the money goes along there. You could buy watches for next to nothing. Watches which you'd have in a window or going under a glass of water, or you could get nice for soup if you had the money. Little mate of 500 2 days. You could have a great time. And so, as I said, you work Monday to Friday, up in the hills, if you had no duties, down to Hong Kong, everywhere you did it. And then back on the Sunday night, work Monday to Friday, and back down to Hong Kong.
So, what other things did you get up to in Hong Kong?
Well, I say, one was there about 3 or 4 weekends. But we used to go down, a lot of it just went sightseeing. Find out there. There was the old Outer Bounds areas, which had been put up by the military police, and there was all the areas, no-go areas.
So even in the city of Hong Kong, they had the same
no-go areas? Oh, yeah, Kowloon and Hong Kong still had the Outer Bounds areas. And we used to walk across on the Star Ferry, and we'd go to these big nightclubs, and you see, we didn't have any cities. If you were garrisoned there, you could buy cities, all you need was a nice white shirt and shorts and that. We didn't have any because we were born where we were born. And therefore, we were nearly always in uniform. So you had to be on the lookout for military police if you were drunk or misdemeanor or anything like that. But if you were in cities, well, you could be anybody, you know. And you could go along and you'd see all these, skyscraper thing, but these multi-story flats and all the clothes and that kind of thing, very eye-opening to people who would come from this country, never been abroad before, and see all this people living one on top of the other, and everybody running around, they're driving a rickshaw, get some 3 or 4 of you get in a rickshaw each, and tell the lad, the rickshaw tell us to race, and an extra this, and then you did the old thing, because when they're running, the shafts of the rickshaw have a bar across the front, and it comes over the front, and then you have the arms over the shafts, and you run. Or if you lean back, you can lift them off the bottom. And so you get them going, and then you would lie back in the rickshaw, and he would go up in the air, and his little legs go like that, and everybody was—it was just devilment, young lads, high spirits. I really enjoyed it.
Was there much fraternisation with the local population?
There was, you know, the girls
in
there.
In particular the women.
Plenty of girls there. It was all right. And then, while I was with them there, it was like for 1 week, they brought us down from... They brought us down from the camp. And they took us into a camp in Kowloon. And we had to do amphibious training, which was, why they picked on us, I don't know. Somebody says we're going to land behind the Chinese land, you know, the Korean land, that put the shits at us. But never mind, we had to have these landing craft. So we had one war where it would carry a platoon. And there was three sections. There'd be a section down the left-hand side, one down the right-hand side, and one in the middle. And you had RDSC or somebody, sitting down on the top of it, steering it. And there would be maybe four of these things. And away, because there's a lot of islands around Hong Kong, and we'd be away on these things, and we'd have to do these landings on these beaches. So, you know, the boat would come to the beach, down would go the ramp, get to run out, and get down in the sand, and advance, and go up and take a hill. And come back. We had a week of that, and I got to know it in Europe when you get to Korea, you're going to land behind the lines and that. But it was another thing which was interesting. We hadn't done it before. It was new, and we were in Kowloon. So on a night, if you had nothing to do, you could go to Hong Kong or Kowloon. But by the way, we could last out. And it was great, you know. And also, you see, in Kowloon and Hong Kong, there were garrisons, there was the engineers, and there would be infantry regiments, and the medical people. There was, you know, it was a garrison, wasn't it?
I was going to ask you if you came across the regiments or the people who were garrisoned there, the soldiers.
You know, you met the artillery, especially in this camp, I met a lad. It was funny, it's a small world, and I was in the campaign in this camp in Kowloon, and I thought, what about that? And he was a lad who had been evacuated up in the Durham during the war. He stayed with his grandparents in the same village as me, and I went to school with him. Then I hadn't seen him since, and he was in the engineers out there, and I bumped into him and nothing. You know, it's a small world, and obviously got a few pints in there. But see, I was moving on, he was stationed there, he was lined up, and it's in a small world. And so that was really, that was over Christmas time as well, because I was trying to have Christmas in Hong Kong, and then just after Christmas, January, we moved out, and we went to Japan.
What was the... You mentioned the other place, that it was near Fan Ling. How big was that?
It was just a small village. Then, it was...
Because you mentioned going out there for night, evening.
It had a few shops. It had a dance hall, a few beer bars, obviously a railway station. And it was like on a crossroads. The huts were, the buildings were globally sort, you know, the mud with whitewash on, and the dance hall was an ordinary dive, and the people, either shopkeepers or just peasants who worked in the fields. It wasn't a big metropolis, it was just a bigger now, I would imagine, but it was the last, I don't know how many railway lines are in the new place, there can't be many, because this one, he went from the station and wound his way around, and so finally it was the last stop in the new territories. The next stop was the Chinese border, and the train went on up into Canton and up into China. And obviously it was an important, strategically I suppose it was important, because of the railway line, because of the road, you know, which came out the hill. There's a way into Hong Kong. Down towards Hong Kong, if anybody was attacking, and of course the Chinese as well. We're having trouble with it. We don't know if it's coming on it. He's the one that's taken over. He chased the nationalists out. And, I don't think he would ever come into Hong Kong because they regarded it as an unofficial way for the West, wasn't it? But, I mean, still, up until they took it over, it was they turned a blind eye to the trading and that.
So what were the local people in Fan Ling like? How did they accept you? Because it must have been more or less a garrison type of town.
Well, they accepted us because we brought money to them. Whether they liked us or not, it was money. Okay, we got paid in, I think it was Hong Kong dollars, we got paid in, and then, of course, they would accept English money or Chinese money because of those. I mean, you could buy, there was the local photographer. He would come from Fan Ling, he'd get permission to come around the camp and he'd take the photos. The local, I got a tablecloth made, embroidered with a day-eye badge on and all the rest of Hong Kong, embroidered, and they send it home for you. And you could buy china, a tea set, and you hold it up and you get the watermark on the bottom. You could buy those things and they would pass the book and send it. Give them your address, pay them money, and they'll send it home for you. So it was all business for them. They were pleased to have you there because it was they could make money out of you. And of course, they were getting all your books as well for the fees. They would be buying that the next one out there. But possibly they were selling, I don't know, fruit to the army or whatever you want. It was money for them. It was, I suppose, without the army being there, they would have a lower standard of living because you'd have nowhere to sell the goods. You'd have to look for them out there. And of course, on a night, if we were down in Fan Ling, and you're going back to camp, you'd have the push bikes and the seat on the back, like the crew of a taxi. And they used to sit on the back and they used to pedal you down to camp for tuppence or shillings. And so everywhere they could, they made money out of you. They used to come along selling bottles of Coke and orange or whatever. And I always remember the first time since the war, the currency bars before the war, they had like a gold wrapping around them. And I'd never seen one all through the war. I'd never seen one after the war. When I got to Hong Kong, it was like a they were flooding them, can't do the country bars. The gold, like the very thin gold coloured wrappers that were on, like sort of paper. And
I'm selling them in Fan
Ling. In Fan Ling. When you were playing football on the teams, I was telling you, they would come along selling pop and sweets or anything like that. It was, they were all little traders, you know, making a living off the lads.
So you were there over the Christmas?
Aye.
How did the Christmas go?
Well, it was just a good meal. That was all really. There was no. Well, we would have a holiday, but there was nothing to. Nothing much.
What about contact with home at this point?
Just mail. No phone calls. Well, nobody had a phone call, I did. That was the mail. Just write a letter.
So did the mail catch up with you in Fan Ling?
Yes. There's one thing about the services in that respect. When we left this country, they gave you the address or the name of the troop ship. And they said, tell your parents or your wives that that's your address for the next 6 weeks. So you could pick your mail up at most different ports if they sent it earlier. You know, it would fly it out to Suez. You know, the boat stop and you might get a meal at Suez. The next one might be Singapore and then Hong Kong. And then when we got to Hong Kong, we would say, right, we're arriving in Hong Kong, we want to be with the Ulster Rifles, the addresses, BAOR was British Army over the Rhine for Europe, BAOR. There was a post, like a postcode, and you got the letters in Hong Kong. And then he used to say, right, I'm moving on to Japan. I can't give you the address until. So concert, but by then it was about 12 weeks off. The further it was going, it was about there was one of the films that we saw where there was a reporter going out while we were out there, and it took them 5 days to fly out. They flew so far and they had to stay overnight. And flew so far and it took them 5 days, so that was 5 days airmail. And so the seamail, it took us 6 weeks on the boat, so anything heavy, like a food parcel. It was at least 6 weeks old by the time we got it. And so news was old news. When news to it, but it was really old. But the papers that we used to follow, there was the Durham Advertiser. I mean, it's still going now, but in those days, what interested me most was nearly everybody who got married would have the wedding photo in the advertiser. And you could have a look, and if I didn't get an advertiser or a letter from home, somebody in the hood did, and say, well, hey, they're still, oh, look, I got married. And that's one thing about being in the Dillons, and being with the lads, local lads, you were never short of news from home. Even if you can get a letter, because somebody would say, hey, so-and-so.
And that would be quite important, was it?
It is, I mean, if you were for anybody, if you were with the Signals, the Royal Corps Signals, or the Royal Engineers, you might be the only draw in the air. And so there was nobody to tell you about what was happening back home if you didn't get a letter, but it was all being local lads. Somebody would call me, get to say, you said, look, I'm so-and-so, I've got my, so-and-so, the store was broken into work, and you always have a little bit of news from home. That was one thing about being the local, the county legend. But our correspondence at home was mail, and we used to get cheap mail, we used to get horses air mail, and it was very flimsy, you used to get them, very thin, flimsy things. You write down about three sides of it and stick it together. And obviously for flying. And that was the only correspondence that we had.
Parcels?
Well, I got one parcel. Because it wasn't worthwhile telling them to send a parcel, because it really, when I was on the move, I got a parcel when I was in Korea, when I was walking out here. And they're going to be here for next month. And I got a parcel. But that, and I got a parcel from the Lord Mayor of Durham. But that will come under that later on, at least what the county did for the people. But if I'd been in Hong Kong, I would have been very seized tempted to sign up for the life that I had and for the extra money that we got. Made life all that much easier. And I enjoyed it.
Was that a common feeling?
I think so. A lot of lads liked it.
And obviously you were mixing with people who were garrisoned there.
Because you see, we weren't getting marched up and down the road doing drill. We'd left the square bashing and the training behind. We were doing practical work, what we'd been trained for. We're doing these section attacks, we're doing platoon attacks, we're doing all this sort of thing.
So it was more a tactical training?
Yeah, it was all for what you're going to do eventually.
Because I think you mentioned before you didn't do very much rifle training.
No. We had a fall and flip contest. That was a stick, metal plates up on a ring, on a target, really. And pick teams, and then obviously you've got to play the lockdown. And there was like inter battalion, like competition, also rifles or the drone section. And there was somebody came up, there was a Navy ship in, and he came up. And you had these forms, and what you do is you give them, 10 rounds, and then that's the first team to get the plate. You shoot the plate, and it falls down. And of course, the first time we were all okay, so you and two girls were down first time we were going to somebody else's. And it's all training, and it's a bit of excitement, a bit of, give you a bit of ego, so all would be there, and get them down. But then again, it was we were doing one with the Australians came up one day, and whereas we had all our pouches on and everything, they just had their arms in the pockets, you know, they didn't have any. I must say that was why the beat was good. They didn't leave it, you know, but and the funny thing about it was we had. They had Lee Enfield's seriously. But we had, I would call the modern one, where the back sight of the rifle, you just did the back, turn a little knob, and the back sight came up and down. Now, the 303 that the Australians had was going back, I think, the First World War, where the back sight, you slid a thing up, and it lifted the back sight up. You know, you still had your little thing at the front, your foresight at the front. But for your range, that they just slid this thing up and it lifted the thing at the back, whereas we had a twiddle, which was supposed to be more modern, and, you know, but it was just a difference in
the idea. The Australians still had the older equipment.
They had the older equipment, aren't they?
What did you think of the Australians?
What do you say? What do you say, lads, then? There's a lot of them, lads. We met more of them when I was in Japan and when I was in Korea. You know, it was just being a contingent that was visiting Hong Kong.
What were they like with discipline?
Not much. Not much. They were the law unto themselves, them lads. But they were good lads. You know, they were great. But great to take over from. And great to hand over to them. Great to make out of the line. But they were pretty sick. They still had the old 18-inch bayonets as well. Look, I had the first one, we had the, I think it was 6-inch ones, wood for making toast with.
So you were there for roughly a month.
A month, 5 weeks or something like that.
And you say, till about the January.
Yeah, it was January, definitely January.
And was it to go back onto the same troop ship?
No. The Asterius, which we went out on, it had sailed, made us back home with National Service and going home for the mob. You know, they'd never sailed empty, you know, take mail back or whatever. The troop ship, I'm not sure which one it was either Fowey or the old world. I was on them both. But I say it was the Fowey. It had come in and it had unloaded garrison troops for Hong Kong. Maybe a load of BLI lads to go to where we'd left. But we got on board at Hong Kong and then the boat sailed and sailed to Japan to Kiwi, a big naval base. And we all got off in Kiwi. Everybody got off in Kiwi.
Who was on this other ship? Was it a similar kind of setup with drafts and with similar kind of setup with drafts?
Some people, I suppose, like the artillery and the signals, they didn't have to be acclimatized in Hong Kong. You know, the artillery set the had the 25-pounder. It didn't matter where. You don't really have to go and learn what you used to do. Yes, you know, your lorry brings it along and unhitches it and has to put another sand or what. But we had to do the running around and everything. So there were quite a lot of people who were going out to Korea and obviously it might have been carrying and ammunition and food possibly. You could go on beef and bully, silly rations and everything.
So where did it stop off in Japan? Can you remember?
Kiwi.
Kiwi.
Was a big naval port, and there's a big, it's called GR, the Japanese Reinforcement Base Depot or something. It was like a transit camp, and we got off the boat. There's lorries waiting for us, and they took us to this big RTD. And when we got there, we were took into the coach of a tent or something, I can't remember which, and then we drew blankets. And then and it was the next year, and he said, right, hand your blankets in again. And I suppose on a train, I went up to a place called Harimura, which is a battle school. And the train went from Kiuri to Kagoshima, where the atomic bomb had dropped. We didn't get out, we just passed through.
What was your impressions? What could...
Well, from what I could see from the station, obviously it had been devastated, but we were starting to build it up again, but we didn't get out, we weren't allowed out to have a look. It was like, the train stopped in the station, but I didn't, in that, but it carried on up into the hills, and we got off, the place was called Halimura, it was a camp up in the hills, and I think it was there where we got through the wind again. And it was there where instructors were there to tell us all about Korea again. We learned, I think, we learned a bit more there, what we did with the Ulster Rifles.
So what kind of camp was that?
It was Wooden Huts, so it was more Japanese camp. It had been for the Japanese Army.
During the Second World War?
The Second World War.
Was it a big camp?
Aye, it was a good size. And it was Australians there, and there was DLI there, and there was other people there, already training before the Korea.
Were they all drafts?
Yeah. Right. So there was no regiment there. They were all drafts, no DLI draft, Australian draft.
So nobody was in companies and
no,
it was all, you were all draft.
All draft, all together. Yeah. And they used to take you out. They had mock trenches there, dug, to what we'd be going into. And they had machine guns fixed up on six lines. And then it would have been Japan with paddy fields and everything, which we want to go into.
Well, we'll come on to the train in just a minute or two. You meant, what was the accommodation like at this
point? It was sparse, adequate. It was the old fire in the middle to keep you warm.
What sort of size were the billets?
It was well above 30.
Were you still all together?
All together, yeah. It was a day and night draft, you see. And then maybe to take up 2 hours. And the Australians are meant to take up 2 hours. And you know, the Australians were there. Oh. There was a permanent staff there of British, there was some DLI there. There was Australians there, there was some Canadians there, there was Jews there. These were people who, I don't know how, they'd been in Korea with the battalion and they'd come back. Whether they'd been ill or something, and they said, right, we'll put you in this a battle school to train the recruits, to learn them what you've learned, you know. But as I said, it was day
and what other accommodation was there? What other kinds of things?
Well, there was one of those big baths, right, like a family bath, you know, what the Japanese have, you know. And then there was a way for one girl massage, and the Japanese girls were massaging it.
Is that in the camp?
Just outside the camp. Yeah. There wasn't much, there was an old Japanese who was guarding the camp. He was on the gate. Of course, everybody called him Tojo. I don't know why the Japanese are called Tojo. But,
so, how were you received at this particular camp? What were your impressions of it?
It was alright, no problems, but once again, everybody was strange. They're all, some might have been there a fortnight before us, some might have been there, you know, a week before us, and that's where we first were the Australians there, and they used to go there, just fight among themselves, and drunk, and but they were good lads. Every time they were in a pub anywhere, you know, you know, buy you a drink. We know you've got no money. they were very good, you know.
So, what was your daily life like in that camp? Was
it was in the valley. Get up and break the ice and the water to go to the ocean. It was cold. And then they would say, right, oh, you're going out. And you'd go up and see where the trenches were and the fields, and once again we practice patrols, practice listening patrols and standing patrols and fighting patrols and all that. And then you have to do a lot of night work, do the night work and go out and do these patrols. And we'll fire flares up and the supporters stand perfectly still. And if we need a flare prop, and it, you know, takes a good man to stand that building as he's the bomb. And then they would throw thunder flashes at you and try to make it as realistic as possible. A lot of it was night time, you know. Or there would be a demonstration of firepower, you know. We'd have a Vickers machine gun, a little bit tricked up, you see, and fire it there, and the sprayer of the bullets, you know, and all that. But the same way, we've got to shoot that. It went to here because it was cold. Yeah.
What did that consist of?
String vest, which was made out of string, and then you had your own vest, then you had your own army shirt, and then you had three pairs of long johns. The first belt you had on, you had to stick up the front and the back so you didn't have to take them off. The second pair were like woolly ones which came over the top of that, then you had your trousers, and then you had a cap comforter on your head. It's like a little muffin, you turn it inside out, like what the commando was out there in the wall, your soft cap. But big boots,